Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming. Thanks for coming along today. This is the first function the Sydney Institute has done with the Centre for Social Impact at UNSW, and I'm very pleased to invite Peter Shergold from the Centre to introduce our speaker, Peter.
Well, thank you, Gerard, and on behalf of the Centre for Social Impact, a very warm welcome, and I am very pleased indeed to be partnering with the Sydney Institute on this important function. As some of you already know, the Centre for Social Impact is a collaboration between four business schools, New South Wales, which is the headquarters, Melbourne, Swinburne and UWA. And in one level, it is designed to infiltrate the way that business management is taught in Australia by giving it a social dimension, by talking about philanthropy and social investment and the importance of corporate social responsibility and sustainability. And especially, I suppose, from my and Cheryl Curnow's perspective, the relationship between the private and the public and the not-for-profit social enterprise sector, or the third sector. And one thing that, given my own background in the Australian Public Service, in which I have a particular interest at the Centre for Social Impact, is the deep but in some ways fraught relationship between governments and not-for-profit organisations and the communities on behalf of which they advocate. And that's especially true as many of those organisations have become contracted providers and even start to be seen as arms of government, with the risk that the social innovation that is driven by their sense of mission will subtly and slowly become undermined. And that, of course, is the subject which was very pertinent to the report of the Productivity Commission, which appeared last week. And I tell you that because these interests explain why, when CSI and Cisco wanted to put on a conference about new ways of delivering government, we were so delighted when we were able to persuade Jonty Olive Cooper to come and join us. Now, what you will already know is that Jonty heads up the Progressive Conservatism Project in the UK. And as someone we talked to today said, well, how can you have progressive conservatism? But I think you will see that there is such a thing and is of profound importance, not just for the United Kingdom, for ourselves. He's been an advisor to the Conservative Party's policy unit. And what particularly interests me when I read much of what Jonty has produced is that it talks about the need to re-articulate the relationship between the state and its people. It talks about the need to empower or re-empower citizens and to pursue participatory democracy. And it obviously became obvious to myself that if we were going to do this, we were going to have to radically transform public service if we were going to deliver government in this way. Now, of course, this is just a small part of what is covered by the umbrella of progressive conservatism. And to tell us far more, to give a broader picture, I'm delighted to welcome to the lectern Jonty Olive Cooper.
Thank you, Peter. And I'd like to start by thanking everybody who has been part of the team that has brought me to Australia. It's very exciting to be here for the first time. particularly the Centre for Social Impact, but also Gilbert and Tobin, the Sydney Institute, and the many other people who I've been meeting over the past 24 hours who've made it possible to be here. I thought I'd be given a rather broad title of Progressive Conservatism in Britain, which covers a multitude of sins and policies. So I thought I would just start by setting out a little bit of the context of what's going on in British politics right now. I don't know how much you know. If it's old hat for you, then put your hand up and I'll scoot up. And then explain a bit about what we define Progressive Conservatism as being about, its key tenets. And then, if we've got time, I'll move on to a few of the policies which illustrate that, and you can ask more about that if you're interested in the Q&A after. First of all, I would say that I'm very tired. I flew in last night from London, and so I may not be quite as Rolls-Royce as I would like to be. I hope you'll bear with me. So, just to set a little bit of the political context first, and then the policy context. At the moment in Britain, we've got an election coming up. It must be done by June. It's probably going to be in May. The Labour Party has been in power since 1997. They were coming in after a very long period of Conservative rule. So we've had these two long, long governments, and there's really a strong sense that Labour has run out of puff at the moment. And that was combined with the financial crisis, very severe in Britain, obviously, because of our dependence on financial services, and now has combined also with an expenses scandal in Parliament, which has really raised, the opinion of politicians in the public minds to from a position of disgust down to plain old irrelevance. So that's the context. And David Cameron, the leader of the Conservative Party, which I should say I'm not formally attached to in any way at the moment, although I used to work with him, has articulated this vision of progressive conservatism, which I think is of relevance both to Australian politics and the broader right across the world. My project at Demos is about developing what this idea is. Somebody, Peter was mentioning, said to us earlier, isn't it an oxymoron to talk about progressive conservatism? And I said that actually we were invited to give a talk the other day in London, and the title of which was Progressive Conservatism, Oxymoronic or Just Moronic? So I'll try and persuade you otherwise. So the context for all this in policy terms is what I like to think about as a triple crunch of really challenging problems. We are all familiar with the credit crunch, and that's part of the problem. But really, actually, the crisis that we face in Britain, and I think it's shared in Australia, is much, much bigger than that. And it's important to understand why, about how severe it is, because I think otherwise the changes that we talk about don't really seem that necessary. So I break that triple crunch down into being, first of all, about the immediate crisis of the recession. I know Australia has fared pretty well, actually, in the recession, but Britain has not. We had something like 27% of our tax revenues coming from just one square mile in the City of London that forms the financial district. It's been very severely hit. One in three young people leaving school is now what we call NEET, which stands for Not in Education, Employment or Training. So there's an immediate problem which is to do with the dole queues, which is to do with welfare payments, the crisis in the budget, in the short term, the next 2 years or so. But beyond that, I think there's two other important and challenging crunches. One is a sort of combination of a number of mega factors that we've been putting off worrying about for far too long. These aren't new things. These aren't things that we've never heard before. They're well worked, but we haven't actually done enough to solve them for too long, and now I think they're all reaching fruition. So a British politician Beveridge talked after the Second World War about five giants that policy was at war against. They were things like want and hunger. I think we almost have a new five giants now. Issues like the ageing population. One in four people born today in Britain will live past 100. And yet half the workforce is not saving anything at all for retirement. So there's a serious problem about the dependency ratio, the number of people who are working compared to the number who are not. But, of course, that also has major health impacts and it changes the character of society. So the ageing population is something which we really haven't got to grips with in the way that we need to. We don't have the policy to deal with a challenge which is really extensive. Another one of these mega challenges is chronic and behavioural health issues. The war on drugs, so-called, has not gone particularly well in Britain. Addiction rates have fallen, but not fallen very much, despite a lot of effort. And it extends to other problems of behaviour, self-inflicted health problems like diabetes or obesity. Obesity is rising very fast in the UK. Somebody said to me, oh, you know, if it rises this fast, soon we'll be at American levels of obesity. But I pointed out to them that actually we won't, because the Americans are getting fatter even faster than we are. So it's a sort of race of fat people. As a result, the costs in all kinds of public services are going up, but particularly the NHS and the health service. If we don't check the rate of obesity, it will take up half the current budget for health by 2040. So it's a very rapid increase. So there's a whole variety of issues in there, and I'd also include probably mental health issues in there, which have been sharply rising, issues like stress, depression, anxiety disorders. So another one of our giants. And then just two to finish off. There are lots I was thinking I could describe, but two to finish off on that. One would be a crisis of Britain's international position. We are losing, I would say, the war in Afghanistan at the moment. But we are also hideously overstretched. The army is working double time, really, and wasn't designed to fight this scale of conflict. We've got a number of major big-ticket defence items, like aircraft carriers, which need renewal and which we probably can't pay for. The Trident missile, nuclear missile system, is also up for renewal. There's lots of debates at the moment about whether that should be renewed, considering that it costs £20 billion. So there's a whole variety there. Also, in foreign affairs, we're slipping down the rankings, I would suggest, over the next century, unless we change our tactics in relation to the European Union. We've got a seat at the Security Council, but I can't see us keeping that in the current format in the world of 2050. So there's a major foreign policy challenge there. And the final challenge, I suppose, I'd put would be one of trust in politicians. Democracy is dying in Britain. If you look at voter turnout, it's fallen very sharply, particularly since about 1992. And it's predicted to continue falling, even though the election that's coming up, I would say, is a real crunch one. Local government elections are much lower turnouts, perhaps 18 to 20% turnout. It's pretty poor. And as I say, the position of politicians is now really, really low. We've had sort of a spate of vigilante attacks against politicians who've been known to be abusing their expenses, where people have egged them or set fire to their lawn or that sort of thing. I think the public have moved beyond outrage to just not caring about it anymore. So that's the context of that crunch. And then just when you're thinking, oh God, what a tirade of pessimistic predictions for the future, when we come to try and deal with these major short-term and long-term problems, we find that we don't have any money. In fact, actually, it's much more severe than not having any money. Having no money would be marvellous. We've got about minus £2 trillion worth of money. So it's really important that we start to address the budget deficit. The sort of situation that's going on in Greece is perhaps, well, I don't think it's likely to spread to Britain, but people have spoken about a downgrading of British credit. And it's if you don't take action, then that sort of thing starts to come onto the table. So a really severe combination of problems. And so starting from that point, when we think about progressive conservatism, it's important to understand that this isn't a question of shaving 5% off the budget here and there, reducing the size of the workforce in the public sector a little bit, perhaps. None of that will be anything like enough to cope with the kind of challenges we're talking about. So we really have to focus on not a 5% improvement in efficiency, but maybe a 50% improvement. And that doesn't mean doing the same thing a bit better. It means doing a different thing, a new thing. So the background to progressive conservatism is to look for a new model. So in a nutshell, then, I'll move on to trying to define broadly what it is, and I can give you more specifics if you feel like it, but I thought I'd keep it relatively high level so that we can skip through in the allotted half hour. The first thing that's important to say about progressive conservatism is that it is not, well, I hope it is not, a kind of bland centrism. It's not moderate conservatism. It's not halfway between left and right positions. I think that the sort of apocalyptic scenario I just painted for you dictates that that wouldn't be a particularly sensible idea, to just go fairly slowly in a compromised position on all policies. What we're aiming to do is something radical and different, and I hope that's conveyed by the seemingly contradictory terms in the title. And I suppose in a nutshell, in one sentence, I was asked to describe it in one sentence, I think it is about moving from a conservatism that's about cutting the supply of the state to a conservatism that's about cutting the demand for the state. And that is, in a way, a subtle or a technical difference, but actually involves a big change in the way you think about what you're trying to achieve. So, to my mind, it's nonsensical to say, right, we don't like having a great big bureaucracy, let's make it smaller. It's big for a reason. And you need to reduce those reasons, and that will mean that the size of the state will fall as a result. So it's putting the horse before the cart to say, why don't we just cut everything by 20%? We can't. Well, we can, but you'll just put the social problems off the balance sheet to fester elsewhere. You're not really actually achieving the outcome you're looking for. So that's a key tenet of what we're trying to set up. I think that's supported by three new trends that are, I think, make it at the time very ripe for a new type of conservatism, a new resurgence on the right. One is the disapproval of top-down mechanisms, of a state-driven approach to solving social problems. What we've seen in Britain over the last 13 years, new government came in 1997, enormous public will, one of the biggest majorities we'd ever seen. I think it was the second biggest majority in British history. Very popular, charismatic leader. They had everything they could possibly need, including an enormous budget surplus and a booming economy. And they threw so much money at the social problems and so many brilliant people's ideas at them too. And they were not able to really solve most social issues that we're facing in 1997. We remain a country that is struggling with the same kind of issues we were struggling with then. So if that doesn't work, and if markets don't always work, because these by definition are public issues, they're issues which markets would solve if they would come into, private enterprise would come into if it could, then the important thing to do is to think about, well, what can you use to try and influence people's behaviour? And you notice in the triple crunch I described, the biggest changes, the biggest growing problems were all problems of behaviour. There were these problems like reducing people's carbon footprint or healthy lifestyles or antisocial behaviour or drug addiction. So there's an enormous amount of new science about the way we behave and how we can change our behaviour. You might have heard or read the book Nudge, which made quite an impact in British politics. There's a whole slew of other texts, I think, probably influenced by Robert Cialdini, would be the one to go away and read if you wanted to pick one up. To understand how behaviour is changing is key territory for Tories, I think, for Conservatives. The second of those trends that I think makes things interesting is that there's a social aspiration gap opening up in Britain. What I mean by that is the gap between what you say you want to live by and what you actually do live by. So I find myself, everybody does, I think, all the time saying, oh, you know, I really care about climate change. I really feel that's an important issue to prioritise. I'm going to do something about that. And then I take a 12,000-mile flight to Australia. Or you say, I'm very passionate about developing world issues. I really care about the condition of people in the developing world. What do you think of my new trainers? So there's this kind of gap between what we say we want to do and what we actually do. And that links, of course, to the behaviour issue, because behavioural science and herd or peer effects can help us overcome our personal inertia by being part of a group that is moving in a direction. But at the same time as that injects a note of pessimism, actually what we've seen, I'm not sure, I couldn't speak about what's happened in Australia, but over the last 15 years in Britain has been the rise of a number of new cultural social movements, things like the slow food movement for organic food, or the Make Poverty History campaign, which had a big effect in Britain. So it is possible to create these cultural changes, and I think that's one of the directions that Conservatives should move in. Connected to that is an idea of stewardship over the future, passing on something to future generations, which I think has become particularly acute. So that kind of idea of stewardship is very traditionally conservative. It's a Burkean notion of society handing something on to the next generation. So I guess we've outlined a little bit about what the kind of headline about progressive conservatism is. I'll try and break down a little bit for you about what we actually do arising out of that. My project works on... I would say that progressive conservatism projects Demos is not the entire gamut of progressive conservatives in Britain, and there are people who have other views, but we define the core areas of work along four strands, and first of which is about power, localism, and neighbourhoods. If you read any social attitude survey in Britain at the moment, and I suspect it might be the same here, there's a palpable sense that people feel powerless. They feel like they cannot influence their own lives. They feel like the people who really call the shots are rich bankers or powerful and sometimes corrupt politicians, and that the daily issues that bug them, they can't deal with. And that might be because they don't have legislative power. They feel like they're too distant from Parliament. But actually, it goes down to a much more micro level than that. If you're woken up at 3 in the morning by the bar down the road, then who do you call? Do you call council? Do you call police? Is this something you call the business executive about? You're not quite sure. In our urge to create an efficient state, we've created a state that's so complex, it's actually quite regressive. It's hard for people, especially the most vulnerable people in society, to navigate it. So that all contributes to this sense of powerlessness. What we do about that, to my mind, one of the major areas is to take government down, not just to a local level, but to a neighbourhood level. We've been doing some work in Birmingham, which is an interesting city because it's Britain's second biggest city, and it's an interesting city because it was almost totally bombed to pieces in the Second World War, rebuilt with a lot of social housing estates. It's also the largest local authority in Europe. It's got about 1.5 million people under their jurisdiction, and so the problems of local government are acute there because local action isn't very local there at all. We've been looking at a couple of estates there where neighbourhood action, just residents who live on a street deciding to get involved and all self-organise themselves, has probably saved, on one estate of 10,000 people, I think it's probably saved back of the envelope about £180 million over the last 10 years. That's just one little estate. There are 300 estates like that in Birmingham alone, not all doing that kind of social action, but if we can generate that sort of enthusiasm across Britain, then we could be really onto something. So we're looking at ways in which the state can pay and reward neighbourhood activity, which is leading to a direct saving in reduced graffiti or drug addiction, whatever it might be. The second strand of our work focuses on childhood and the early years. Now, this is quite a departure for Tories. Are you familiar with the term Tories? Does that make sense? It's quite a departure for Tories because traditionally they've been very set against intervention in preschool years. They see it traditionally as an intervention that shouldn't be there, but and rather a nanny state thing to do. Why should you be telling me how to educate my 3-year-old or 2-year-old? But actually, if you really want to reduce the intervention in people's lives overall, then the place to focus, I would say, is doing to be much more decisively and vigorously early on. And by doing that, we know we can have major effects on getting to the heart of social problems, like, for example, crime. And educational disengagement. So it's really important, I would say, to refocus our attitude towards the early years and both implement more and better schemes, and particularly schemes that are targeted to getting the poorest families in. We have a scheme called Sure Start in Britain, which I think you have a kind of analogous organisation here. And Sure Start has been effectively captured by the middle class. It's free service and it's pretty flexible as to what it offers. So now what it mostly offers is jewellery making classes and yoga for yummy mummies, and it's a very expensive scheme. Poor single mums don't go there because they feel like it's not their kind of place. So we think it's very important to refocus on that and also think about relationships. Traditionally the right has a kind of mania with marriage, and the left says it doesn't matter what your social circumstance and your family structure is. Both those things are wrong, in my opinion. The left are wrong to say that it doesn't make a difference if you're brought up by a single mum. It does. It's really tough work, you know. It's hard to be just one person looking after a number of kids. That's why we feel sympathy. That's why we provide benefits for those people. It's obvious that that is a difficult situation. But that doesn't mean that you leap to saying marriage is the answer. So what we are really trying to do there, and it's a pretty ambitious thing to do, quite an interventionist thing to do, is to find a way in which the state can promote love. It's a bold thing. But we found some ways. You can do simple things to help encourage relationship advice before you go into marriage. I mean, if you were going to the Congo, you wouldn't go there without taking your anti-malarials. But if you're going into marriage, then you quite often just wade into it because you're in love. But actually there's some pretty simple things you can do, just like taking a questionnaire where you compare what your attitudes to money are to your partners and then discussing that. These kind of measures can cut the risk of divorce by a third. So some of those things are things that we're pushing. I'm relatively short of time, so I'll press on. The third strand of our work concerns poverty. And here we're trying to reshape conservative attitude to poverty, to consider, to move away from an idea of that you're poor because you're lazy. I mean, that is a crude stereotype, obviously, of a subtlety of most conservative thinkers, but that is the public's voter's stereotype of what people on the right normally think about people in poverty, that they don't really care because it's kind of their fault. We are trying to reshape that conception in the public's mind and in some, I have to say, some people on the right's mind. And the way we're doing it is by thinking about poverty in a what we call a thick conception of inequality rather than a thin one. A thin one would be to think about inequality of income, primarily. A thick one would be to think about all the things that lie around that and are connected to it. And that would include things like poverty of aspiration. If you come from an estate like the ones which I've been visiting recently, I met a kid who works who's on this estate, who's saying, I went to school here, my mates are all here, my family are all here, this is my home, you know. And I said, that's great. It's great to feel so bonded to a place. But how often do you leave the estate? It sounds like you do really a lot. He said, oh, I never leave. And I said, well, when was the last time you left this estate? It's not a very big area. It's about 1.5 kilometres square. He said, I've never left. You've never been out of this area. You're 17. Right? So it's quite hard for people in the middle class to understand that if you don't have a car, if you live in a remote location, if you live in a place where there are no jobs, then you may have a very limited mix with people of different social classes to you, and that has obviously a big effect on your aspiration, both what you think you can do and what you can imagine anybody doing. If you don't know any architects, you're not very likely to decide to become an architect, for example. So to think about poverty of cultural capital, of civility, when you go to an interview, do you look the right part? Can you fit in? Very often you're at a cultural disadvantage before you even get through the door. To think about particularly character and capabilities. I'm not sure whether capability theory has really is the term you're familiar with here. Does that make sense? Nod if it does. Nobody's nodded. So capability theory derives from the work of Amartya Sen, the Nobel Prize winning economist, whose book on justice I would recommend to you very strongly. It's really interesting. And Sen's idea of capability to ruthlessly squash it down is basically that to be truly free, you need the capabilities to author your own life. And these are maybe hard skills, like you might need to read and write, but they might also need to be soft skills. They might need to be skills of persuasion and skills for yourself. The ones people usually talk about are agency, so a sense of control over your own life, long-term thinking, so that you don't think, oh, I've got a credit card, I will rack up a massive debt, being able to think about yourself in the future, determination, these sort of skills. And there's a lot of evidence, quite a lot of it, a little plug, quite a lot of it done by Demos, actually. I would recommend the Building Character report that was just released recently, to suggest that these capabilities can be built, they can be trained. If, for example, you are privileged enough to go to a school that plays rugby, which is probably every school here, but in Britain is a sort of a wealthier schools, then, and you do a tough tackle, and you were scared, but you overcame that, and you got in there, and you made that crunch tackle, and you felt good, and your teammates patted you on the back, and your coach noticed, and your parents on the sidelines noticed, then you feel good, and you feel like you can overcome danger or your fear, and then that happens to you 10,000 times between when you start and leave school. That will make you braver, and that effect will be lasting. That's a slightly kind of crude way of putting it, but these character capabilities can be trained, they can be practiced and improved, they're not purely genetic. And so, this is probably the most controversial thing I'll say, and I hope you don't misunderstand what I mean, but and so to create a kind of soundbite out of that, in the 19th century you might have said that the view was that you were poor because you were lazy, and in the 20th century you might have been saying you're poor because of your social circumstance. In the 21st century it's a bit of a sleight of hand, but you might say that you might be lazy because you come from poverty, or you might find it hard to concentrate because you come from poverty, because you might not have access to the resources which allow you to train these capabilities in your early years. Some of them can be trained by your parents, but if your parents are working five jobs to bring in enough cash, then you might not see them as much as you need to develop those capabilities. So that's a really fundamental shift for Tories in the way they think about inequality, to think about not just how do you address what you might see as actually the symptom of inequality, which is a low income. What do you do to address its root causes? And then the fourth strand of our work concerns the shape of the state, and this is where our work tallies very closely to what the social Centre for Social Impact has been working on. To my mind, as I said, it's putting the cart before the horse to try and reduce the size of the state forcibly. It reduces when social problems reduce. And there's an enormous number of new and exciting techniques which are being tested and employed, usually not by government, on the fringes of government around the world. And I think these add up to a really exciting new agenda for what the state can do in relation to its citizen. Politics are full of false dawns, and maybe this will be another one, but I think there really are some exciting things going on there. Just to touch on one or two. One is social design, which is, I think, brilliant and very exciting. Social design is the idea that you take the approach of an ethnographer and a product designer and a policymaker and mix them all together. And so, for example, there are people already who work in experience design, which is, instead of designing a table or a chair, you design an experience of, say, booking a holiday or taking a flight, and you design what's it like from when you decide you want to take a holiday all the way through to when you're sitting on that airplane. Is there all the right things you want at the right times? Is it an easy process? People are now taking that approach and applying it to dealing with government. So say you have a disabled child. What forms of support are available to you? And are they in the format that you want them? And are they there at the time that you want them? Almost always not, no. Because they're designed by people externally. But if you work with people who are in the target group, then you can often not just learn from them, but actually teach them to design the new process, the new service that would fit them better, using the techniques of anthropology and design. So they very often go and live. There's a brilliant study, the Just Coping study by the Social Innovation Lab in Kent, I would recommend, where the social designers went and lived the life of single mums for 8 months before they even began to try and coach the single mums to design the services that would help them get back into work, not the services that we thought would help them get back into work sitting in our ivory tower in London. So social design is one. Personal budgeting, which I think you have had some experience with in Western Australia, is another. And I think a big and exciting area is crowdsourcing. Crowdsourcing is the idea that you can learn from the wisdom of many, many people to solve a problem. This was pretty hard to organise before the internet. It's pretty easy to organise now. And an example, it's not my example, it's Don Tapscott's. But an example that I think brings it out nicely is the Goldcorp mining company in Canada. Goldcorp had a big territory which it couldn't find any gold in. It was on the verge of bankruptcy. And all their miners were on a strike, and all their shareholders were getting pretty itchy, and it looked like it was all over for them. So in desperation, it's something very unusual. They published all their confidential and proprietary data. The share price collapsed because it showed that nobody could find any gold in this area. And they offered $500,000 Canadian for anybody who could find a new source of gold. And not just did people get involved in the search and, you know, find one or two teams, one or two types of gold. About 10,000 teams got involved. They were organising themselves on the internet. They were usually people who'd never met. They communicated just by email. They brought in all kinds of capabilities which the industry had never thought of using before, like dendrochronology, satellite imagery, mathematics, all kinds of things that they hadn't previously thought about using. And they didn't just find gold, they found 128 seams of gold. The company went from being bust to being worth $13.2 billion. So, if you can do that in mining, can you do that in drugs or rehabilitation or improving accident and emergency care? And yes, you can. And so we're exploiting that different relationship with the state. It's really fundamental to progressive conservatism, because when you start to get into that kind of way of thinking, then it starts to be that the state is a platform, a resource of money, of expertise, that you draw on to achieve what you want to. And so it stops being something which you delegate. Either if you're in poverty, perhaps you come to rely on it, you acquire learned passivity. Or if you're middle class, you might say, well, you know, I don't need to give to charity because I pay my taxes. That's my moral conscience clear. Instead, the state becomes something which is the adjunct and the help and the catalyser to helping you achieve what you want to do. And that leads me on to what I'll probably close with, which is the concept of the big society. David Cameron has been very influential in pushing this idea, which is that the real role of the state is not to make the government more efficient, cheaper, more effective. The real role of the state is to be a catalyzer, a resource to draw on for the third sector and for civil society. And that what we want to try and do is build a society where everybody is a volunteer, everybody is a member of three or four societies, everybody knows their neighbour, and that's really the objective of social policy. And when you get that right, then you get everything else right. Everything else bleeds away from that. So, I hope you have some questions. There's loads more I could talk about, but I'll leave it to you to throw some to me.
Many thanks to our speaker, and we'll come to questions in a minute. We'll finish no later than 7 o'clock, and I want to say thanks to Gilbert and Tobin for the use of this great facility this evening. Just a brief first question. Fascinating talk, which sounded a bit pessimistic. No, a serious point. I mean, you made the point that perhaps by 2050 Britain mightn't be on the permanent on the Security Council as a permanent member, but it could only get off the Security Council if it voted itself off because it's got a veto. I mean, no one from France would ever sort of contemplate the French not being there, so why does an influential figure in Britain think this might be possible? If we had a young man from France, he wouldn't be saying that, would he? Can you just come back here and sure, talk about that?
Would you mind if I took my jacket off, by the way?
No. I'll help you.
That's quite right.
That's a very, very depressive concern.
It was a good question.
So,
just take your tie off.
This isn't the full Monty. Well, not yet.
It could be.
So I suppose it is pessimistic, yes. But I think that, well, on that particular issue of the Security Council, I think that British diplomats have spoken about how it might be more in our interest to not have a 1 in 5 vote in an organisation that loses legitimacy because it is overly dependent on a 1945 world order, and to strengthen the vote of people who we assume or hope would be natural supporters of British-style policies, probably India being the one that most British diplomats looked at. So I think they would say, isn't it great to have a veto on an organisation which nobody cares about? Would be their kind of line of thinking. I think on the wider issue, then the way I think about it is, I'm a historian, and I look at the role of powers like Spain or the Dutch in the 17th century. Dutch, fantastically modern, exciting country in the 16th and 17th century, and still a very big trading power with quite a lot of foreign policy influence through the 18th century. 19th century, nowhere. Nothing. You won't read anything in international relations books about 19th century Dutch foreign policy. It's still a nice place to live. It's still a pretty good standard of living. It's peaceful. But it disappears from the world scene. That might not matter. You might take a kind of Nordic view and say, if we're okay, then that's fine. But I think that's really not very sensible because it's a bit of a boring cliche to say about it. It's a network world and these kind of things. That's very true. But it's absolutely not in our domestic interest not to address issues like poverty in third world or free trade or carbon exchange, because they have a direct impact on the lives of people in Britain. Aside from which, I think there's a kind of powerful psychological impulse in Britain to not give up on being at least almost a world power.
Some years ago here at the Eastern Institute, we had a speaker from Britain, I think he may also have been from Demos, talking about some of the new initiatives of the then very new Labour government.
Tom Bentley.
Oh, great. That's great. Yeah.
And he mentioned, I think, the idea of the training institute for young parents, and which seemed like, at times, it might be a really good idea. And now you're reporting that back that this has turned into, the government's got a lot of money, this idea turned into a jewelry classes for young middle class mothers.
Yeah.
Isn't a lot of the other ideas you're talking about intended to the same sort of thing, where you identify a problem, you come up with something which will hopefully be a silver bullet to kill the problem, throw a lot of money at it, and you time some more people reporting back about how it's turned into something completely unintended? And,
yeah. Yes, no, and no. So, no, we won't throw a lot of money at it because there isn't any money to throw at anything anymore. Yes, because I'm very aware that the group of people I work with and many of the people around senior politicians at the moment are young, white, privately educated, went to Oxbridge. They don't have a very adequate conception of what it's really like to live in poverty. Almost everybody makes policy is making it, they're fit, healthy, young, urban people, making it for rural, unhealthy, criminal, elderly, you know, etc., groups which they are not, and they can't let every person experience it. So it's totally possible that my hopes will be dashed. And I didn't really go into detail very much on the policy that we have behind this, but somebody said to me this morning, oh, this is great, but this sounds quite a lot like Tony Blair in 1995. I was flattered by the comparison. And I think, in a sense, the vision is similar. The aspiration to where you want to get to is similar. The ideology is quite different, I would say, but maybe the end point is the same. The difference, I think, is the tactics used to get there. And so a core part of progressive conservatism, which I didn't put in, but perhaps should have done, is to try and never do any doing, really. And to create a system which you deliberately try to have no answers to the questions that you're posing, but you set it up in such a way that other people can have those answers. So an example perhaps would be the payment by results system, which we've been advocating and the Tories are going to do in rehabilitation of prisoners. It costs £35,000 a year to keep somebody in prison in Britain. We have a rising prison population, it's at record highs now. In fact, so high that we had to release a whole load of offenders early, some of whom went on to commit some quite serious crimes. So there's a prison population problem. And the problem isn't really that lots of people are committing way more crimes. The problem is that when you release from prison, two-thirds of people will go back into prison in 2 years. And I would say that's partly because when they leave prison gates, there's nobody there to collect them. They've got £40 in their pocket and that's it. So they go back to hang out with their mates and he's a drug dealer and that's what happens. But I wouldn't claim that I know how to rehabilitate prisoners. So instead, the system that we would design is to say, right, well, for every year that you're not in prison, that's saving us £35,000. So if we give you a job lot of 100 prisoners, random mix, you can't select which ones you get, so you can't select ones you think will be easier to rehabilitate and others not. And you come back to us in 2 years, there's a single outcome we're going to measure you on. How many of these guys are no longer, are not in prison again? So have you managed to rehabilitate them 2 years down the line? And if they have, then we'll pay you £70,000, right, which is the money we save. If they haven't, then we haven't really lost out on anything by this system because they're back in prison, which we're going to pay for anyway. It doesn't matter at all how you do that. We don't care how you do that. So to be totally neutral on the mechanism, but very clear on the outcome. And in that situation, then I hope that if I have an idea and it's not a very good one, it doesn't really matter because only the people who have ideas that do work will be able to enact what they want to do.
Right down the back. We're going to be brief with a lot of questions here. So
try to talk. How do progressive conservatives view the changing racial and ethnic demographics in Britain, particularly on place?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I suppose. First thing is that we haven't done much work on that, so in a way it's like we've got quite a small team and we work on the kind of priority areas that we talked to you about first. Second thing I'd say is that progressive conservatism is interested in communities of place more than communities of interest. It's a myth, I'd say, to say that there's been a decline in community. It's just different types of community. I don't know my neighbours and I would count myself as quite socially active and willing to participate in the community. I don't really know them very well. But I do know loads of people who are also interested in progressive conservative politics I've never met because we're all friends on Facebook. So there's different forms of community. I think it's really important, though, to get that community of place right because there's quite a lot of studies that show that if you feel bonded to your place, then you don't drop litter, you know, you do turn out in elections, all those kind of things. So we shouldn't ignore that. And therefore, it's a bit of a caricature, but the view is that the previous policy has been based on sectional interests, you know, attending to, talking about and describing, using the words of saying the Muslim community, for example. We'd say there is no such thing as a Muslim community. There are people who live in Bradford and many of them are Muslim. But do you see what I mean? Do you see the difference? So I guess that's the way that we would think about it, but... It's something I deliberately don't research or work on much because basically it would be pretty uphill because immigration and cultural issues are very loaded, and I feel like I would get this much policy return for that much effort, whereas on some other issues I can get that much return for that much effort.
Has there been any... Obviously funding is a big, big problem with the principles and strategies that you're espousing. Has there been any partnering of government with private enterprise, corporate bodies and so on? As there has been only slightly in Australia, but it is increasing, I think, with some publicly listed companies having as a clause in their constitution that they actually give so much pre-tax, their pre-tax profit towards worthy causes. And
so yeah, so that's an interesting issue, actually, because it's something that progressive conservatives have talked about a lot and is very much in conservative for the big C, the party, conservative party rhetoric. So one of the very first things that Cameron talks about was the chocolate orange problem, he described it as, which is these little oranges. I don't think you have them in Australia, because I mentioned it something this morning. They had no idea what it was. You do? Right, okay. Maybe they just weren't a chocolate addict. That's probably what it was. And they put the check out at about child height. And he said, you know, this is just wrong. And you can make money off it, and there's no rule against it, but just don't do it, right? And so they have an idea of responsibility deals, which is sort of like regulation, but not. Where they say, why don't we all come together and agree what basically is the morally right thing to do as an industry with government, and then you do it. And then if you don't do it, then we would regulate. But you do it in your own way, and you can design it. So the win for business is that it's more flexible for them, and there's much lower admin regulation cost, except if they're not to be doing it. So there's that side of things. More broadly, one of the key architects behind Cameron's thinking has written a book called Good Business, or he wrote it before he went into politics, in which he kind of created the idea of corporate social leadership rather than CSR. Corporate social responsibility is where you say, look, we chopped down rainforests, but it's okay because we give money to the Puppy Dog Foundation. And that's basically balls. And corporate social leadership is where you say, what would be really convincing and really good PR would be if we actually did it, if we actually were a good company. And that would also have the upside of being the morally right thing to do. So I think that's pretty heavily embedded in British corporate culture, led by big companies like Marks & Spencer, which is a high street chain. They have the so-called Plan A, because there is no Plan B on climate change. Those sort of things have really set the tone. So I think it's big.
I think
we're
going to
move on.
Yeah,
there's a question here. Yeah, someone here? Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
Hi.
In a historical sense, just to place yourself, if you take Sir Robert Peel, Benjamin Disraeli, Lord Salisbury, and Margaret Thatcher...
Disraeli.
Yeah. Is that where you're going to place yourself?
Well, yeah, it's very much... it is a very explicitly Disraelian vision of conservatism. Disraeli, this 19th century prime minister in Britain, when he was a young man, wrote a book called Sybil, in which he coined the term two nations, one nation conservatism. He wrote about how Britain was two nations living apart, unlike in kind and motivation. I can't remember the quote, but he described a society where it wasn't just a difference between rich and poor, there was also no mixing between them. And I think there's a palpable sense in Britain that this problem has re-emerged, that there is an underclass that is, despite the sort of bottom third by income of British population, has done pretty well under Labour, and that's good. But there was a bottom 5% or 2%, very, very expensive, and very, very unlinked to the rest of society. I was working with Westminster Council recently. They estimate that they have about 120,000 families in that area. They estimate that 85% of their social budget is taken up by 300 of those families. So there's often families where you're spending maybe 2 or 3 million a year on them, and they live in abject poverty. So how does that work?
No idea. Andrew? Yeah.
Yes, thank you for an excellent talk. I was wondering if you could tell me, is there a split in the progressive conservative movement between those who might be economically and socially libertarian, and those like Philip Blond, who are social conservatives and economic communitarians, who really criticise the free market economy?
Yes and no again. So I think overall, no. There's this marvellous unity, really, between this is what's enabled Cameron to break through with his own party and the wider conservative movement, between fiscal conservatives and people who are interested in social justice, who actually often are social conservatives as well at the moment. But because if you solve a problem, then it you don't have to pay for it. So the roots of the small state that we just talked about. There is I wouldn't describe it as a split, but there is another school of thought, separate but part of the gamut of progressive conservatism, the red Toryism that Philip espouses. Philip was my boss when I arrived at Delos. And I don't disagree with a lot of what he says, but I don't really feel like he puts the priorities in the place where I would put them. Just to fill you in, this red Toryism, the idea really is that both the markets and the state are inhuman, expansive, and dehumanising, and so the little man in the street needs to be protected from both, both through kind of things like cooperatives, but also through pretty tight regulation in some circumstances. But I wouldn't put myself there, but yeah, you're right to pick up on the difference.
Question,
yeah.
Obviously, right at this moment in our state, my son has a mental illness, so he gets some services from small non-government organisations, people who do it are passionate, they've been doing it for years, and yet the government says, well, we've got to save some money, so our public servant comes in, and we think we're going to cancel that. You know, everyone has to protest to keep this alive. And this is happening in a number of institutions right at this moment, because the people who seem to want to keep things going, because of their own energy and drive, can't, and it seems to me that a civil service is too remote or removed, or all they are concerned. Someone said, you've got to save some money, they'll better go. How do you get those two things to work together?
Okay, so on civil service reform, we have that can be a problem in Britain too. So I think that really, it's very odd to me that, a bit like teaching, so I always think, which I used to be a teacher, I always think this is quite odd, but it's the kind of thing which you go into at 21 and then you just stay in forever. And it seems very odd that government might be a thing like that. But I can't really talk about that because I'm a bit like that. Arguably, I would say that you need to have a much more flexible system of recruitment than the civil service. Most civil servants who are coming from university are recruited bang straight after university. It's pretty hard to join mid-career in Britain, and there's quite a lot of proposals we have on that. On your kind of broader point about that, well, I think it's part of what we call the post-bureaucratic age, which is moving to a system where you're blind about who does what you want doing. You're just clear about the outcome. So it doesn't really matter if it's a charity or a private company or whoever it is, it might be the state. You don't care. And in that system, if the agencies you're talking about are effective, then they'll win contracts and be paid by their results.
You mentioned the holistic approach the Canadian company used to find gold. I was wondering whether you people, you know, when you study the complex social problems, do you use the modern systems analytical, holistic, as well as cybernetic methodologies, which includes complex theories, chaos theories?
And short question.
Right. No, I don't. But I'd like to find out a bit more about systems thinking. One of the UK's leading systems thinkers, Jay Chapman, came from Demos, or was at Demos, and so his thinking has permeated into our thinking, but I myself am sadly, woefully ignorant of it.
And then we go there.
How much of what you've spoken to us about tonight has actually made it into the Conservative Party's platform for the election?
About 10%. About 10% of the policies I advocate, you know, get adopted. But the culture and the way of thinking, about 60-70%.
And what's the 10% from tonight?
Proposals on school, on the pupil premium in schools, which I actually didn't talk about, but it's a voucher system which the poor receive much more. They get more vouchers than wealthier people. Proposals on relationship education, on ways of making the Sure Start Early Years programme target the poorest, a big load of stuff on data transparency, publishing basically all government data on all government activities. I hope my neighbourhood's proposal is going to be adopted soon. There's a variety of things.
Okay, should we go there and there?
Yes, I was just wondering if there's an issue with globalisation for a potential brain drain or a significant brain drain occurring in the environment that you're outlining for us. And
You mean from...
You mean people leaving Britain?
Yeah, yeah, people leaving Britain. There's a lot of people.
They won't all hear this talk.
why would they leave Britain? That's a risk for every... every country, not just every Western country. I think, no. I mean, the bigger risk is that our economy was built on four things, which is public sector spending, housing boom, North Sea oil and gas, which has run out, and Canary Wharf, the financial district in London. And all of those things have stopped. So we need to sit down and think not just what are we going to do in the next to get through the next year or so. We need to think about what are we going to get to do to get through the next 30 years, which would be in a whole other lecture. I have stuff I could talk about there.
In 2007, we had a change of government from Conservative to Labour, and that Conservative government was elected in 1996. A number of the ministers in that government would view themselves as progressive Conservatives. Yet at the end of that period, we had an outrageous level of middle-class welfare and expenditure in this country that's dragging our budgets down. One of the reasons is it's very hard to make the ideas that you're espousing tonight politically saleable when people are used to getting something. How do you make them attractive?
Good question. Short answer is we don't have to at the moment because there's a massive budget crisis, and the Tories have been very skillful at shifting the argument from saying the problem was too little government, too little regulation in the city, to saying it was too much government, and government's consuming, you know, government debt repayments are now bigger than our education budget, for example. So people really got that idea that it can't go on. And so I think that has made that sellable. In terms of if that hadn't happened, I don't know. I mean, in Britain, once the party wins, it really has a lot of power because we don't have a federal system. So Prime Minister could probably do mostly what he wants if he has a big majority.
And just finally, what chances do you think David Cameron has? I think you've been a little bit ambivalent about whether he can win in his own right. Mm-hmm. Just would you...
Well, I know we're on the record. I am quite concerned that he won't win. I actually said, I was speaking to a Fabian Society group the other day, I think it was them, or is it Qualities Forum or something like that, a left-wing group, and I said, look, if you care about progressive left-wing issues, then you better vote Conservative, because there will be nothing worse for you than David Cameron with a small majority, where he's in hocks to the right wing of his party. Since I said that, the poll majority has narrowed, so that now I think on the latest poll they would win 7 seats, which isn't enough for a workable majority. So there's quite a risk of a hung parliament. But I think if that happened, I don't think it would actually be so very terrible, because it would enable Cameron to not do the hard right things that some people might want him to do, because he'd be in coalition with other parties who would say no. So I think it would actually bring him more to the centre, potentially. But... yeah, in my view, it's knife edge at the moment as to whether they win or whether it's a hung parliament.
Many thanks. Take a seat. Well, many thanks to John T. Olive Cooper for a great address tonight, and a timely address, but also a thoughtful address. And I think we all learnt a lot about contemporary Britain and about progressive conservatism and about what's going on in Demos. And for someone who's just got off the plane, it was an extraordinary good performance. So many thanks. I know there are a lot of people here and we're right on time, so I'll just say thank you to our speaker. Thanks also to the Centre for Social Impact, to Cheryl and to Peter and the rest of the staff there for helping us tonight. And you mentioned what might happen in 30 years' time. Well, I don't think I'll be here, but you certainly will be. So we'll probably see you back at the Sydney Institute in 30 years' time. If not. But for tonight, well done and thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.